Hey everybody, it's Magellan here. You know the drill. You're listening to the latest season of Chat's, a television podcast on Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, entitled Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats. As we've said before in these intros, this season was recorded a few months ago during quarantine, so some of our topical conversations may seem a couple months out of date. If you like what you hear here and you want to listen to us talk about other shows, you can search our backlog in your podcast app. Just put the name of your show and see if we've done it. And if we haven't done it, send us an email and ask us to do it. We would love to hear from you. So anyway, totally unrelated sentence that I interrupt by saying,
live from Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats, it's Wednesday night in quarantine.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season
10,
Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats. My name is Alan, and I'm joined by Magellan, who doesn't have a baby. You don't have a baby? Everyone has babies. What are you doing without a baby?
I'm the baby.
That's the sequin, is I'm the baby.
I'm the baby.
I can't have children because I'm children. It's just repulsive.
It's
I don't
blind
even
leading the blind, you know.
Exact. Wow.
Isn't there already an idiom for this? It's like babies raising babies. What is it?
Sure. Yep. That's it. You nailed it.
You got it.
I think there is an idiom that's like it's like a baby raising a baby or something.
If you baby, right. Therefore you baby. Yeah. No, I hear you.
I'm right. Baby.
Post baby, ergo proctor baby.
That's exactly it. If you can't tell, folks, I'm also joined by the person whose liberal guilt literally will not stop spewing out of her ears. It's six, everyone.
You know, it's not just liberal guilt, it's just general guilt.
General guilt reporting for duty? Here we go. It's the time for the podcast. All right. I'm here all week.
Sometimes I think about there's a webcomic called XKCD, and one of the comics they did that really stuck with me was a pretend like capture where they're like, okay, so in order to help identify you, we're going to need to answer you to answer a question that only you will know the answer to. Where are the bodies hidden?
just testing, just in case you know it. We're here to talk about some truly cursed episodes of television, folks. If you don't already know, Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats is the podcast where the Chats kids plus the Scanline Media half kid discuss Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. It's a television show by Aaron Sorkin, and this week we watched episodes 5 and 6 of Studio 60. Episode 5 is called The Long Lead Story, and episode 6 is The Rap Party. The Long Lead Story its teleplay was written by Aaron Sorkin, and its story was written by Dana Calvo. It was directed by David Petrarca, and it originally aired October 16th in 2006. Magellan, what happened in The Long Lead Story?
In this episode, while the cast goes through rehearsals with Lauren Graham and Sting, Odell tries to get the story on Matt and Harriet. Meanwhile, Jordan passes on a lucrative but tasteless new reality series. Okay, do we have to talk about this one, or can we skip it?
can we technically say that about every episode of the show, but we have to
No, because I think many of them are bad in interesting ways, and I think this one is just purely boring.
Yeah. It's deeply boring, partly because it's just setting up the next one. Like, the show decides that it wants to have, like, a plot of the week, but then also sometimes it's like, this one's entirely about this very small thing that's going to mostly make sense in the next episode. Mm-hmm. I think it sounds like you did not love this episode, Magellan. Is that accurate?
I just think that the Matt and Harriet stuff is like
disgusting.
Here's my thing with Sorkin. I think I have a lot of things with Sorkin.
Hell yeah. You could probably kill him.
Probably set up a bingo board of, yep. of things that we say, and one of them is, here's my thing with Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
But, like, he really, more so, I think, than have, like, focusing on the relationships of characters, he focuses on the, like, events of relationships that characters have, as if those are the relationship, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
And then he just constantly is reminding us about, like, stuff that has happened with Matt and Harriet. Like the fact that the going to the going to the whatever and getting the boot is like a plot point of this that is found out. It's like, are you going to keep reminding us about this all season? Are you going to keep saying, hey, that thing that I made up, pretty crazy, right? That make 'em up that I did, it was really wacky and good and says a lot about like who these people are. And it's like, no, Aaron, not really. That was not a believable moment. It wasn't handled as like a shameful thing for Matt when he did it. So like, yeah, I don't know.
And it's weird because so in our last episode and also the last episode we watched, we were introduced to Martha O'Dell.
Yeah.
And there's an episode of The West Wing where there is a documentary crew, and that makes for a really cool episode because the episode is framed as basically they filmed this documentary and shit happened that was like confidential, so they had to hold off releasing the documentary for a couple of years.
Oh, fun. Mm.
And it's a really interesting framing for an episode. And so when they're like, oh, okay, here's Martha O'Dell, I'm like, oh, okay, so they're going to use this to give us a different perspective on the show. And it's like, oh, no, they just wanted to have someone here to tell us what we should really be invested in is Matt and Harriet. And I'm like, you're wrong. That's not what I should be invested in because my life is whatever, but my sanity I do actually value.
Yeah. And she plays this role of not so much like the press or of a usual journalist where she's trying to learn about the truth and facts. She's instead trying to dig at something that nobody's like okay saying and nobody's mm-hmm. been thinking about that much, both us, the viewer, and the characters. Like, I don't think Matt and Harriet I didn't feel in the past couple of episodes like their lives are centered around each other. And this episode and O'Dell's questioning suggests that like this is the most important thing on the show. Is that you need to understand that the only reason that both of these people are successful is because of the other person and their care and concern for the other person's success and well-being. And that's all that matters.
They asked Christine Lottie to unbutton her shirt so you'd pay attention to this plot you didn't care about.
Exactly. So now you're looking at her boobles instead of realizing that this is nothing. I almost found myself more interested in like the MBS Jordan McDear stuff, her trying to like buy the script for that TV show, which is called Nations, and it's a show about the goings on at the UN. And I think it's this is a plot line that briefly comes up in the second one where someone is like, isn't it nothing that teens like more. I think it's Jack Rudolph who says nothing teens like more than reading subtitles, which first of all, Jack Rudolph, anime. Second of all, Jack Rudolph, the UN show Nations is the West Wing. It's basically the West Wing. Like, it's replaced the UN with the White House, and you're saying right. Aaron Sorkin wants to do a show about politics. Like, he does this. This isn't weird. he's selling his own show on his own show.
But it's even, like, I mean, at least the West Wing is about American politics. The UN, like, it's a weird position because through like there's sort of the two threads there, right? Where there's like, oh, here's the UN show, and like, oh, we should really have this. This is going to be great. And no, that sounds like a dumb idea.
Yeah.
And it seems like it would not find an audience. Maybe it would be an interesting like art piece. I bet it would be a bad TV show. And then the other thing is like, oh, but there's also this reality show, and that also sounds like crap, and Jordan's arguments there make sense. So it's like it's split there where it's like, you're fighting for this show that sounds really dumb, but you're fighting against this show, and your arguments against it make sense where you're trying to do this whole thing where you're revitalizing the image of the network, and obviously you don't want a show like this on it.
Yeah. It just seems like the thing that Aaron Sorkin champions is people trying to seem smart.
Oh yeah? Let's talk about the next episode.
Well, yeah, when we get to the next episode, that's going to be a big a drum that I'm going to beat the whole time. But yeah, his like this contempt that he has for the trashy reality show, which sounds like a pretty trashy reality show, granted, but also I don't know, like I might watch it.
Well, you're all the way down the Shark Tank hole. There's no more saving you from bad reality.
That's true. I'm a bad man.
Well, but also, I mean, he's erecting this like
a complete straw man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah. I have seen some bad reality shows, And I would say some of them are mean-spirited, but they're not, like, the premise isn't necessarily mean-spirited. It's in the direction and the producing where they push people to be mean-spirited. It's like, the pitch of the show isn't like, what if we gave two couples knives? Like, that's not how this works.
Yeah.
It's surprising that this show sounds, within this, like, it's going to do well. Because I'm like, wow, it immediately would get blowback from people being like, this just sounds mean.
Like, also, who would go on? I mean, like, people want to be on TV, but it's like, okay, we need 12 couples. One of you will get $1 million. Everyone will have their lives ruined. Sound good? Great.
Yeah, he's constructing this thing that it's really easy for Jordan McDear to say no to. And so then when it looks like this huge moral victory for her, and Bradley Whitford's character is like, ooh, Jordan McDear, maybe she's cool, which seems to be the only thing that he does, that Danny Tripp does anymore, is every episode he has a scene where he's like, wait a minute, Jordan McDear's cool.
Hold on.
What if it's a cool girl?
Yeah. So it's like, that's not that cool that she passed on that, because it does sound super trashy. I think we've said it, that it's a straw man. And it's not as bold as her passing on, like, you know, a singing, dancing competition show or something.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, that's more of a stance and I think more provocative. And I don't know. I think it would make Sorkin look like less of a kind of stodgy asshole if Jordan McDear is like, yeah, we don't really want to do shows like that. But then also part of it is that, like, yeah, maybe she's trying to educate the citizenry or whatever by not doing trashy shows. She's also doing it to protect their brand as, like, a smart network.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a business decision there that also kind of murkies the waters of the pure morality of good TV.
And also, I feel like, I mean, as far as it says a lot to me that his idea of, like, oh, the smart show is this show about the UN, which to me seems like empty intellectual calories, right? Like,
yeah.
You're not going to learn anything from that show that's at all relevant to your life. If the pitch of the show was like, we're going to, like, follow, like a small town's, like, city council and it's a drama show, then it's like, okay, that's interesting because it's a political thing. Presumably it's going to be smart and about, you know, like, political maneuvering and stuff, but it's about things that matter to people's lives, as opposed to, you know, no, people in New York City don't really need to watch a show about, like, the various nations of Scandinavia arguing about trade deals.
I think this is a commonality between both of these episodes, where we're punching down at something that we think is low art, whereas the thing that is high art is simply taking place in a more important or more well-perceived setting, like the UN, or like a guy wearing glasses as opposed to a guy talking about his wives.
Yeah, this is Commedia dell'arte again.
Exactamundo. Yeah,
right.
So she declines the show at first, and then Rudolph yells at her, and he's like, why aren't you being more of a sexy lady? And she's like, I'm a feminist. She doesn't say that, but she ostensibly says that. And he gets mad at her, and eventually she does. They take the show because Danny is like, you should take the show. He also tries to set Matt up with a girlfriend at some point. This doesn't matter at all. There's a Jenny sketch that I was thinking about, but I'm also already forgetting about. Basically, the idea is, we talked about, like, oh, Lauren Graham guest stars in this episode. And what that means is it's literally a plot about, like, if you keep cutting the sketches with the guests in them, then you're going to stop getting guests. And that's just so that Matt Albee can go, like, well, the guests would come if the sketches were better. And it's like, I don't think you know why people guest on sketch comedy shows. They're not coming to, like, do brilliant comedy. It's like a promotion thing, dude.
It's also, like, it's a thing where, so the sketch that gets cut is about, like, oh no, like, this lady, like, all her friends have kids and they're pushing her to have a kid and she doesn't have a kid. Oh no.
Yeah.
And the whole time I was thinking about, Alan, you're going to get this because you're probably going to remember the source better than I do. but one of our friends, maybe it was you, relayed to me the line, the womb hungers. And that line is funnier than that entire sketch.
Yep. This is exactly, yeah, that originated for folks at home from a conversation I had with a bunch of women at my last job where somebody brought their child over and like suddenly everybody in the room was suddenly really wanted a kid. And I was like, what was going on? And one of our friends who is transmasculine was like, yeah, that's what happens when the womb hungers. Like, it sees the baby and it's like, I must insert. And I was like, oh my God. And that's just that concept, that idea that like people see babies and suddenly want babies, creeps me out in a way, like a profound way. But yeah, that's way in more interesting and funny. And once again, every sketch in the Studio 60 show within a show is bad. So that stinks.
Well, I mean, we did get the Nicolas Cage show. That seemed pretty funny to me.
I'm so sick of the Nick. It's been two episodes and I already hate it. This one is Nicolas Cage dating show and it sucks.
He's a marriage counselor.
No, yeah, it's marriage counseling and it's just him being like, blah, 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 blah.
And it's the most basic sketch joke of like, and then she's going to leave you and like have sex with your brother. And it's like, wait a minute. Did this happen to the character who's saying this right now?
Whoa.
Oh, that is weird.
I feel like he's overreacting. Oh.
The only believable moment in this episode with regard to the comedy was when they go to like decide what gets cut. And then Danny Tripp about the pregnancy sketch is like, it was funny. And then Matt Albee's like, it was almost funny. It was not good. It's cut. And I was like, okay. A little self-awareness. You purposely made it bad and wrote. That's good. Mm-hmm. But Sorkin he's incapable of doing like original sketch. And I don't think he needs to, but then stop showing the sketch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every second we get of another sketch, I'm like, this... You're not going to address the fact that this show sucks, are you? Because you clearly have fondness for the institution of SNL. You just don't know how to make your own version of that. You're not even a good parody.
I'm still waiting for... So I saw the first episodes of this show because, like a lot of Sorkin shows, my sisters watched it.
Yeah.
And then the later stuff, I would just catch snippets here and there as I was walking through the room when I was younger. And there's one sketch I'm waiting for that I still haven't seen that was, I still think, the least funny writing Aaron Sorkin's ever done.
So oh, boy.
That's exciting.
Yeah. And so the other plot line before we get to it relates back with the Sting stuff, which we will talk about Sting, but don't you worry. It's Martha O'Dell, and she starts off by asking Harriet about her childhood, her relationship to her parents, and her relationship to faith and comedy. We get a like weirdly long, in-depth biography page, basically, of Harriet being like, at first she's like, my dad was never religious, but my mom really was. And then I really got into musicals. And like most people, I went from religion to musicals to improv comedy. And the way that you know that Sting is coming is that the hero over the speaker is his soundcheck and he's playing the lute because he's doing like an acoustic album. This is great. If you're going to use an actor cameo, don't do it the way you did with Lauren Graham. Do it with Sting, where like they kind of understand that Sting's already like a weird dude by 2006, and having him on to play the lute for his like like instrumental like folk music album is actually for once on point.
It's very of its time. Mm-hmm. That positions me in the time about as well as 3-6 Mafia being in the dressing room.
Exactly. And Martha O'Dell's like weirdly very attracted to Sting, and she's like, hold on, you're interesting, but Sting's on stage. And I'm like, it shows her age, actually. I like that she's like that, but Jordan's like, yeah, it's Sting, whatever. Like, I'm in my 20s, I think. And through this conversation, she starts picking at the idea that maybe Matt's career took off when Harriet was on the show, and maybe it's because he cared about her and wanted to write the best sketches just for her. And maybe she only got into comedy really good because she liked him too. Is that it? Did you get it, you guys? That's the whole plot line. You did it. Wow. And it's Harriet being like, no, it's not. No, come on. No, it's just coincidence. Like, love is fake. Like, whatever. We don't actually, we're not, unless, gulp, unless. And so what's weird is this plot like does not really have a third act, if you ask me.
Yeah, it doesn't resolve at all.
Exactly. Because, so Martha like gets pulled around a little bit by different people. Tom, who we learn now, his name's Tom. He's one of the big three guys, is like watching movies in his room and practicing impressions. And one of the interns like tells Martha O'Dell about Matt going to the Bombshell show. And he thinks this is like the biggest deal ever. Like, don't, she can't know that. So he tries to attribute it to something else, to himself, I think, or say like it's not a real story.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone fights, everyone disagrees about stuff, whatever. And then she's heading out and they're like, what are you really going to write about Martha? Like, come on, you're the press. Like, what are you going to write about? And she's like, I'm going to write about the truth. I'm going to write about what I want to write, which we know is going to be Matt and Harriet. And so they watch. This is the part where it really, I was legitimately surprised that this episode was over, because it's Harriet and Matt like watching Studio 60 or something. She's like, Matt, you knocked my socks off. Fade to black. Like, wait. It ends so weirdly. It ends, it's supposed to be this like piece, this moment of like, oh, maybe they do think it's still the two of them. Maybe they do like each other. And like, we know how that's how the show ends, obviously.
Yeah, of course. It's just so, it like, of course they're meant for each other, and it's just tiring, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they've already had a huge blowout. I don't have anything invested in them.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's just boring. And then there's nothing that happens as a result of Odell. Does Harriet even learn about the boot thing?
No.
Or are we going to get an episode where the story gets published and then we have to be reminded of this again?
Please,
that's probably
no.
going to happen.
Yeah.
Just drop the boot thing. It's so dumb. It was dumb the second it happened. I felt like I was in Cuckoo Clock Land. Just no.
Yeah.
Any stray notes, folks, on this episode?
I know we have
meat and potatoes coming
part.
Up, but.
I yeah. really like the Sting part. It was beautiful.
Yeah, Sting plays some actual... He does like a full song. This is, again, a good use of a cameo.
Mm-hmm.
You got Sting yeah. to play and like sing a wonderful song. It's just undermined by the fact that Matt has to tell Harriet, like, I told him to pick this song because I just think it's really good. It's not about us, I swear. No, I swear. It's not about how much I love you. I
like the dialogue exchange, though, of her being like, how does it feel to tell a rock star what to play? And he's like, oh, I asked him. I didn't tell him.
Because it's the one moment where Matt is not like flexing his like power over people also. He's like, mm-hmm. no, I'm just a guy, I swear. Mm-hmm. For once, Matt feels like a decent, regular person. Regular, yeah. regular.
I think what I will say, like you can see from a mile away that Danny and Jordan McDear are going to start making out.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I thought that I was going to be really annoyed by that. And it's so ham-fisted, but I still like it.
I oh, certainly
I'm
like it more
annoyed.
Than
yeah. I like it much more than Matt and Harriet.
Same.
Like Matt and Harriet should just be together, so we don't have to go through this whole like, will they, won't they? Because they will.
100%. 100%.
I actually think that Danny and Jordan is more patronizing than Matt and Harriet.
Well, there's just nothing. I mean, there's nothing to Danny and Jordan right now.
Well, okay, so. Matt and Harriet is like, Matt is like, well, I'm intellectually superior and you're making all these mistakes in your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Harriet's like, you're a petty little fuckhead.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon the language. And then Danny and Jordan is Jordan's like, I think you're cool. And Danny's like, oh, it's adorable that you think for yourself. Like, that's the dynamic.
Sorkin women are something.
For all the problems I have with Harriet, there isn't an episode of Harriet stumbling around drunk and the joke being like, look how kooky she is.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
The last note I had was about a scene where Ed Asner's character comes back. He was from episode one because Rudolph is like, he's the person who decides whether or not this sketch will make it to air. Not the sketch, but the bidding on the reality show, I mean. And he gets like a whole 5-minute scene. This is the thing with talking about Studio 60, is like it's a 45 minute episode where there's just like huge swaths of nothing interesting happening of like B and C and D plots that you're just like, what? Like, I don't even want to put this in my notes. But he has this whole weird moment of like, you know, I'm putting millions of dollars into a city in China that I'm going to turn into the Las Vegas of China. And I'm like, what's wrong with you?
I appreciated that scene because I buy that character as just this like unbelievably self-centered rich man.
Yeah.
Like and he sold that really well of just like, wow, this guy, like realistic, like in a way that I believe is a piece of garbage.
No, Ed Asner is actually a character. It's a version of like, oh, some rich old people suck and are bad. Like, yeah, we don't need to turn Macau into the Las Vegas of China, you fucking millionaire. Like, go go to hell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love how he just like doesn't care, you know? Yeah.
He's like telling this whole thing to Rudolph and to Jordan without them listening. He's just like, anyways, I'm doing a whole, here's where my money's going. Here's how I decide on business.
And then he has no investment really in the decision of what to put on the network. He's just like, eh, well.
Whatever.
What a horrible idiom. You want her to cook the meal, you gotta let her buy the groceries.
and then you just hands Jack his drink and leaves.
It's a bye. Yeah. Ed Asner, the actor, is collecting checks on the show, I can tell.
Good for him. Good
Honestly,
for him.
Yeah. He's doing his thing. And yeah, that's basically all I had. And then the ending truly felt like not an ending. The cut wasn't it wasn't as awkward as I was imagining, as I'm like describing it, but it's pretty awkward. But if we're going to talk about awkward, we do have to talk about the second episode.
Yeah, so, we certainly do. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, the second episode, folks, is called The Rat Party. Teleplay also by Aaron Sorkin. The story is by Melissa Myers and Amy Turner. And for those playing at home, if you want to look this up and confirm whether or not this episode is racist, neither of them are people of color. This was directed by David Semel, and it aired October 23rd, 2006. Magellan, please tell me what happened in The Rat Party.
All right.
Please.
A drunken Jordan makes friends with the cast during an after-show party. Danny tries to get Matt's mind off Harriet with the help of three...
So good.
with the help of three sexy women. Simon makes a plea to hire more black writers, and Cal deals with a mysterious man backstage. So can we just start with getting out of the way that Aaron Sorkin has a deep contempt for women? And it's like inescapable, the contempt that he has.
This episode took me 2.5 hours to watch.
It's a lot.
I had to take like detox breaks.
There's an A, a B, a C, and a D plot in this episode. I've never seen or watched a more bloated episode of an Aaron Sorkin show.
It's really like a barrage of case studies in the white male, worldview. And it's like how you interact with women, black people, old people. Everybody's getting a taste of how I see you in this one.
And it's a case study for everything that's wrong with his worldview, because it's so high and mighty in every facet of this episode. Is like, these men understand women's careers better than they do. Old people are better than we are. And black people don't know how to do comedy. Like, what, dude? What's wrong? This is one of the most frustrating episodes of the show to watch. We're very excited to talk about it. Which plot line do we want to chomp into first? We've got...
Let's get this initial like three sexy women scene out of the way.
Oh, sure. Lacey, so Shayna, and Treasure.
Yeah, and
my favorite, like,
Trinket. Those are Trinket? Did you mean Trinket?
Trinket? No, I'm Treasure.
And it literally has one of them being like, oh my God, can I press this button?
Oh, God!
Sorkin, stop. Oh my God, there's a baseball player down there. I want to have sex with him. Oh, like, what the hell are you doing, Aaron Sorkin? This is absurd. This isn't funny. I'm not laughing with you about this.
I watched this episode at my desk at work, and I was standing up, and there were multiple moments, I'll call them out, where I like reeled and like my feet gave out and I had to sit down for a bit. It's just unbelievably shit. But yeah, so those girls are falling around, I guess Danny and Matt, and one of them keeps battering Matt, being like, what do you do? And he's like, I write the show. And she's like, so when you say you write the show, what does that mean exactly? And he's like, I write it. Like, I put words on the paper and then the actors say it. And she's like, yeah, but like, do you do that? It's like, the simplest job in the like hierarchy of really complicated jobs that come with making a live sketch comedy show, and this is the one that we're like, but what does writing really mean?
Well, it's not. That's exactly the point, Alan. That's just how stupid women are.
Yeah, they don't even understand what writing is.
Yes. Oh my God.
What? What are you saying?
I mean, good for these actresses for cashing these checks, but can you imagine, like, you know, you work your shift here, you play this role, you walk off the set, you get the sec signed. Yep, that's how you say that. The check signed, and you're like, okay, now I'm going to go home and burn Aaron Sorkin an effigy.
can you fucking imagine, like, going to Tisch and reading Stanislavski and starring as Lady Macbeth, and then the big role you get is Treasure, and you're like, I went to fucking Juilliard or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, these women are probably really, really good actors. And the script is like, oh my God, what is that? I'm just so curious.
Can
about,
I press
like,
the button? Darren Wells!
Oh my God.
Yeah, their plotline doesn't even go anywhere. They go to Darren Wells and then they're like flirting with him and the other like baseball boys. And it just.
And then they're gone, right?
They're gone. That's the last note I have about them.
And honestly, I feel like the biggest sign of how stupid we're supposed to see them is the fact that they're going for a Dodgers pitcher.
Yeah, fuck the Dodgers.
Fucking Dodgers.
Baseball.
I hate the Dodgers. Six doesn't the like
other,
the Dodgers.
The other thing about Aaron Sorkin's contempt for women is he really has a hard time. Like in the first episode when Martha O'Dell and Harriet are talking, first of all, he can't write a scene where Harriet just talks about her life without it being about Matt Albee, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. She's trying to make friends this episode. Oh, no, not Harriet. Then, sorry, Jordan's the one trying to make friends.
And then in that scene, he it's worse than failing the Bechdel test. He, like, I don't know how to express it, but he goes from a moment where two women are alone and they're talking almost exclusively about a man, and then they're interrupted to lust over a man, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and then in this one, too, he can't write dialogue for these women long enough before they go to the window and they're like, oh, my God, he's hot.
Right. And I think just, all of the people, like, talking to each other and wanting to be friends stuff is made funnier by the fact that this episode, if you're paying attention, mostly takes place in like an evening, I think, because it's all mm-hmm. around the rat. It ends in like the rat party of the title. And so like Jordan is going up to at first Harriet and Janie being like, hey, like I know I'm like the boss, but like, do you guys want to be friends and like get drinks and not talk about boys for once? And they're like, where are other women? We're not allowed. It's like suddenly Harriet and Janie are like very uppity and they're like, yeah, I guess we can hang out, but like, we're really busy. And we have like social lives. And then she goes up to the two other like main actor guys, who we learn are named Alex and Dylan, which I've already forgotten as I just said them. And she's like, do you guys want to be friends with me? And they're like, oh, you're the boss. Whoa. Jordan McTeer wants to be friends with us, dude. It's so useless. Why does she care so much about being friends with people?
Yeah.
Why do you, Alan?
I don't know. That's why I care so much about friends, because of the clap. So do we want to talk about, we got three major absurd bad plot lines.
You need to stop using the phrase do we want.
Yeah, we don't. We don't want. Should we talk next about the old stuff with Cal, the what's his face stuff, the boy with his parents, Tom, or Tom. The racism incarnate?
I feel like we need
I want to end on the racism.
Okay. I was going to say I want to end not on the racism because I don't love to carry it. You're going to carry that weight.
You're going to carry that weight.
But that's where the real,
yeah.
That's where the real therapy.
That's
needs
the thesis.
To
yeah, that's you end therapy on the crying, from my experience. You don't start on it.
We'll zip ourselves back up at the end, but I think we got to warm up to that.
So I want to talk about Tom because this plot line blew my brain open.
Yeah.
So Tom, one of the main actors on Studio 60, Is having his parents over tonight to the show. He's very excited. They are very much boomers, white people boomers. His dad doesn't really talk to him, and his mom is very concerned that he cusses too much and talks about having sex. He is walking them through the studio, and he's explaining to them the joke, the classic Abbott and Costello thing, because they were one of the people who came to this show. He's explaining who's on first. And he's like, you guys know who's on first. Everyone knows that. And they're like, what? And he's not having the real moment, which he should be having, which is young people more like who's on first isn't it's important to comedy, but not everyone knows about it. People who care about comedy know about it because that's like one of the first things you learn about. But it's not ubiquitous to
I mean,
you know,
it was taught in high school for me.
It was showed it. I definitely like watched it in high school, but I just like I like this moment ubiquitous. Where the parents are like, no, it's not ubiquitous. Like, we don't know it.
It would be fine if it weren't for like overall like the nonstop cluelessness of the portrayal of these characters.
Of the parents, yeah.
Yeah, where like they don't know the name of their son.
It's embarrassing. I had a theory there that I posited, which is that maybe the dad is like his stepdad, and you were like, no, they're just getting the kids mixed up because it sucks. And because Sorkin needs us to know that he has another brother. He has a brother named whatever, Mark.
Yeah.
So, all right. He shows them who's on first, and they're like, we don't know what the hell that is. And he's like, wait, why do these boomers not know about the best, most perfect comedy thing of all time? And that's fine. And then he continues to walk them down, and it's this very like...
Do you think that Aaron Sorkin has a genuine fondness for who's on first? Do you think that he's putting that on the turntable and just like having a ball?
This episode has two examples of him being like, listen, I've got comedy chops. I'm cool. Between this and him being like, nobody's funnier than the Marx Brothers. I don't think he knows that those are funny at all. He just knows he's supposed to think they are.
He's supposed to think they are. Yes, that's how I read it. He's portraying Tom as somebody who thinks that who's on first is essential comedy, but like, it's fine.
Right. Like, here's what a real comedy aficionado likes.
Would like.
Who's on first.
It's like when I was writing a fanfic and I was like, oh, I have to write someone who has a lot of opinions about whiskey. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah. I'll just BS something. I love bourbon. So there we go.
The thing that I'm sort of able to express right now that Aaron Sorkin does not understand about comedy people. Like, I did comedy stuff in college, and I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert, but at least the like people who enjoyed comedy who I would hang out with in college, they would – I don't remember ever talking to them about who's on first.
Yeah,
I'm sure if we ever did – we talked about it in like a making fun of who's on first sort of way.
Right.
Like, comedy people are not reverent. That's the entire thing. They are irreverent. They don't.
No, but
they
the
don't
sanctity.
Sort of hold up like, oh, this is the greatest thing of all time. Like, they'll find old stuff that they think is funny. But yeah. None of them are like, man, Bob Hope is still real funny, you guys. I love that guy. When he comes out with the golf club and he talks about his wife or whatever, like, no, some of that old stuff is just kind of boring.
It doesn't hold up. Bad. It's bad. Yeah.
And it also gets back to something we've said before, which is how this show doesn't understand that comedians are like inherently people pleasers, right? Like,
yeah.
No one's going to get self-righteous about comedy. They want you to laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one moment of self-awareness here is when they're like, he talks about who's on first again, and they're like, wait, what's the joke? And he's like, all right, well, one of them is actually, if I explain this joke to you, it'll be weirder and less explainable than like just listening to the sketch.
Yeah.
And so everything starts to build.
Which is also not a comedy thing, because comedy people love to describe sketches.
To do the whole sketch, yeah. He would never be like, I can't do it, you should listen to it. Like, no. He would play both parts, and he'd be like, no, you do this part. So the frustration and the awkwardness between his parents and him is growing. And eventually what happens is he's raising his voice because they don't understand the difference between skits and sketches. This is like a semantics thing, because technically, yeah, sketches are like written and skits are improvised. Usually is how those are defined.
So I've taken the stand with people in my life of like, okay, there is a difference between skits and sketches, but the way that Tom does it in this scene,
yeah,
makes me want to call every sketch a skit for the rest of my life.
Right? Yeah.
It splits me around.
It makes me someone who has been pedantic about it in my life. Like, I've done the thing that he's doing, but he does it with such contempt for his parents and with such reverence for, like, the genius of sketch writing that it's like, buddy, no. That's not, I'm sorry. Like, some people are really, here's the thing about comedy. Some people are really funny, but like, it's not genius to be like, let's put John Belushi in his samurai outfit and he crashes through the ceiling. Like, that's not,
that's just, and that's literally SNL. Like, come on.
That's just goofy. It's just like people come up with goofy stuff.
Cause it's funny. Like, what's it called? Like, in last episode when Harriet is like, yeah, and then the bear goes rawr. Like, I think that's kind of funny. It's not that clever. It's just kind of funny to hear.
Yeah, so much of it is just like, you know, I think people who are really good at comedy, the thing about it is like, as they get better, they don't get more brainy about it. I think they get less brainy about it. Like, in my experience of having done improv, when I was first learning how to do improv, everything was very mental, right? Mm-hmm. And very like, okay, this scene and this is this kind of thing and like this is game or like that's how this works. But the more you do it, the more you're like, yeah, this will probably be funny, because like a similar thing was funny before. It becomes intuitive in a way where like, if Tom was really a comedic guy, I don't think that he'd talk about it that way. I think that he would speak fondly about the space, and it's believable to me when he tells the story of the theater. I think that's cool.
Well, and also
this sketch thing is like, chill out, dude.
There's also this element to this where I feel like what Sorkin doesn't get, and a thing that he's consistently failed across every show he's ever done, is he wants his comedy to prove how smart he is. And comedy is very often about intentionally dumbing things down, right? I don't want to use the phrase like lowest common denominator because I don't think that's true, but it evokes the right idea where you're not trying to raise the bar, you're trying to lower it to a level where comedy can communicate things that other things can't, because you're not trying to make it too sophisticated, you're just trying to make it funny, which everybody can get.
Right, comedy doesn't have to be a high art. It's not. Like,
and a huge part of comedy is like making yourself the fool.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'm Bobo.
And
the
he
fool.
Doesn't really have a willingness to do that.
No. It's very. This show is very sanctimonious about comedy. In both these, in this and the next poem we're going to be talking about is like, no, comedy is a sacred, like, long running industry that we need to contribute to and then get out of because it's beautiful and we can't corrupt it. Whatever. Blah blah blah. And so Tom is getting mad at his parents, and his dad drops the best line of the episode, which I'm going to be playing a clip of here, but he says, "That's swell, Tom, but your little brother is standing in the middle of Afghanistan." What are you saying? Why?
Yeah.
The dramatic, like the high drama, melodrama of this is, it's so much. "That's swell, Tom, but your little brother is standing in the middle of Afghanistan." Doing what?
I was texting this to our group chat a little bit earlier, but something I think we've mentioned in a previous episode is how baffling it is that when you watch a Sorkin show, it's like, this is kind of goofy and bad. Mm-hmm. But then actors, when they talk about performing Sorkin's writing, it's like, oh my god, the man's a genius.
Yeah.
And I really think part of the reason for that is because Sorkin writes really melodramatic, hard on your sleeve kind of stuff. And sometimes it's fun. Like, I'll be honest with you, I enjoyed watching this episode.
Yeah.
Straight up, I enjoyed watching it. There's a lot of problematic stuff that made me cringe and twist my whole body like 360 degrees and then unravel like a sort of cartoon cat in heat.
Nice.
So, you know, there's definitely bad here, but like, I enjoy watching it because you're seeing characters behave and talk the way that maybe you feel, but you've never seen anybody do that. But what it ends up reading as is like, all of these actors are doing their sort of drama class scene studies that they've been practicing in their garage with their partner. and now they're doing them in front of their class, and everybody's like, wow. When you did the scene with Tom saying that his brother was in Afghanistan, that was so powerful. And it just feels so like abstracted and devoid of existing within this world, because it's just like a, I feel like I'm looking at actors doing the like trouble with your dad scene.
Yeah.
Well, and I wonder if it works better when you are an actor in it, because like it's not like these are shot like scene by scene, right? It's not like they show up for a day of work and they scene by scene record the entire episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not how filming works. And so since for them all of this stuff is happening a little bit out of context, like every scene feels like you're doing the climax of something, and I can imagine as you're doing it you're like, wow, this is some really amazing payoff to a different scene. And it's like, no, there was no scene building this up. It just happened.
Right. That's a good point.
Yeah. How do you tune into that moment of like, all right, so now I've been walking around with the son for a while and I got his name mixed up, but I need to blow up in his face because he's yelling at me about skits and sketches and his brother is in Afghanistan. Okay. Hey, like all of this setup, and just how do you like turn your brain on to that? It must be really difficult, but mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bad line. It's not dwelled on. I think it's intentionally not dwelled on. The whole point is like this family understands Tom's relationship to his brother already, and he feels like he's living in his brother's shadow because they think of comedy as like a fake art and like not a real job, and you know, the classic stuff. Even though he is on, like, if we're to do the real world equivalent again, like he's one of the leads on SNL. Like, what are you talking about? Your son is unsuccessful.
Right.
But also we do get as he's taking them out to the car, we do get the moment of the mom being like, thank you for using your money from your jokes to buy body armor for soldiers in Afghanistan.
Completely not. I thought I dreamt that line. Thank you for confirming that line's real.
It does make you feel crazy to hear that.
She's like, thank you for Mark's unit received the body armor that you purchased for them. I'm like, what the fuck? That's so twisted. This comedian's buying military equipment for the kid.
This feels like another plot line that's born out of it seems like a mission of Aaron Sorkin's with Studio 60 to try to like bridge the growing partisan divides in the United States. And it really makes me think about like if I was the age I am now in 2006 and I was watching this show, would it feel smarter and feel better then in that time to be like, oh yeah, there's a woman who's like a devout Christian fundamentalist but also a comedian. Oh, this guy who's like a classic Hollywood liberal has a brother who's in Afghanistan fighting, you know, defending our country. Thank you for your service. And I think we've talked about this before, but like I was definitely a lot more wrapped up in those partisan divides and like trying to think about ways to reconcile them years, like a decade ago, than I am now. Because I think now at this point, it's like that battle's lost. Like we can't. I don't think that it's productive to try to do that.
And we also know that that conflict was not the way that the media was portraying it. You know, it wasn't the troops saving us from the bad guys in any way, shape, or form. So, like, everything about this whole, like, defending the troops narrative kind of rings extremely false now. So I do think it would work a lot better at the time. That is something to consider.
Yeah, it makes me think about Jon Stewart going on Crossfire. And him, if you've seen that clip, and him talking to Tucker Carlson and the other guy and being like, you guys are hurting America. sort of feeding into and acting out these divides and claiming that you're trying to find middle ground is like actually damaging.
Yeah. I should watch that clip again. That sounds interesting.
Oh, it's pretty good. Before we move off of the Tom and his parents thing.
Yeah, yeah.
There were actually two things I liked about it. Well, there's one thing I liked about it and one thing that I'm curious to hear your thoughts on.
Sure.
I thought the moment where they were going to leave and the dad was like, do you need any money?
Good line.
It was actually a really good line.
Yep, and I agree.
A really great acting moment where you can see the guy who plays Tom. He does a really good job playing out like, I'm offended by that. Oh, I want to tell my dad that I'm really rich. Not going to do it.
Also, probably not really rich.
Also, I do kind of appreciate that he's like reaching out to me and trying to mend fences a little bit. It just is such a complex moment. And as someone who like personally, you know, I think has had moments of trying to figure out where do we meet in the middle with a parent. That moment rung really true.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, we're just people trying to live our lives and we offend each other sometimes and we're just trying to figure it out. So I thought that was well done. The thing that I'm like curious to hear both of your thoughts on is what do we think about the fact that like Studio 60 is canonically in a theater where like other real life stuff has happened?
Wait, what theater is it in?
I don't know if it's a real place, but Sorkin through Tom's tour is talking about how like this is where they made the announcements about Pearl Harbor and like this is where, you know, XYZ happened. Like he's continually placing Studio 60 in the real world as if it has always existed and everything else has existed normally.
I mean, I feel like that's the only way you can do this. It is kind of weird, but it can't, you know, like, this can't end, like, the show can't end with someone, like, realizing that, like, Danny Tripp is, like, psychically projecting this studio onto the normal world, and if they kill him, everything goes back to normal.
Unless they have to
pretend that this was always the case, or it's bizarre. Like, this isn't Persona.
you're selling me a much better show.
I am, so it's true. Good.
That would be so, so good.
If someone was, if, you know, like you know, midway through the season, someone says, like, you know, like, it's Saturday night. And I was like, wait, why did I say that?
Hold on.
What?
He wakes up sweating in his bed next to his wife. And he's like, I dreamt we were on a sketch comedy show. And she's like, go back to bed. Yeah, I mean, it's a show commenting on society a little bit. So it has to exist in society. It's like how the newsroom has to reference real life events or else none of its like news segments make any sense. Because they also do like, there's brief bits of Weekend Update shown in this episode when we're cutting around like Simon. And Harriet is like reading her script. And I was like, wait, are the things she's talking about in her Weekend Update bit real? I forget what she was talking about, but it was all like, wait, I could look this up, but it's specific enough that it could be true. And it was just like pulled like by an intern for a 5-minute scene. And it's not important news that like made it onto the internet. I don't know. But I think, yeah, I think to answer your question, having it take place in a real space on one hand is important to like making the show feel realistic. And then on the other hand is like, what is it mapped to? Is it supposed to be the SNL studio then? Because again, the SNL exists. So,
I mean, you know, I think it's not hard to imagine that there would have been a competitor to SNL.
Yeah, I mean, like, is it the Ed Sullivan Theater, which I've walked by plenty of times? Like, is it that? Because I don't know who was there at the time. What was his face there? The guy who has the big beard who interviews people.
Guan Yu.
Yeah, Guan Yu from Three Kingdoms. Magellan, who's the
guy who has the beard who interviews? Why am I
forgetting his name? I'm so embarrassed.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I know what you're saying. He like had a whole website.
He's got like he's got like a Netflix show now.
Oh, you're talking about David Letterman?
I am thinking about David Letterman.
Oh my god, I was thinking about something else.
Oh man. Okay. I think David Letterman was in the Ed Sullivan Theater before Colbert took it over. So maybe they were in the Ed Sullivan Theater instead. That's what it is. I don't know.
I think they're making up. This is LA.
So no, I'm
it's in LA.
Wrong.
Right, it's in LA.
Yeah. So this is if they had built another studio in LA, this is what would have happened.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it would have been this one. So to pivot a teensy weensy bit, speaking about the theater and about old times, this next plot line, we just keep rolling with this episode. It's the episode that keeps on giving. Cal, in case you forgot, is a character on this show who finds an old man wandering around backstage. How this man was let past security, I don't know. But he was let past in the sort of chaos of it all. And he seems very senile. And Cal asks him to sit down and goes through all the boring protocol of like, do you know what your name is? Do you know why you're here? How did you get past the people? Like, what's your deal? And the guy just seems completely out of it. Again, this is Eli Wallach, which is funny because the character's name is also Eli. They are just doing what if Eli Wallach was on, like, what came to our show. They might as well have just used him as his real name. Because he's a guy, except I don't think Eli Wallach was in comedy. I don't really like know the guy that much other than
or World War II.
Or in World War II. Yeah, I don't think he won the Battle of Normandy. And so he asks him what his name is. The guy gives him a bunch of fake names about like all the people who are blacklisted in Hollywood for being Jewish, if I'm not mistaken. Is that the idea? That's what
I
the
think
black
it was like a McCarthyism thing.
Right? Yeah, so he was...
Not for being Jewish, for being accused of being communist.
Of being communist. No, you're right. Sorry. And so he gives them all these fake names. Everyone else reveals stuff. Finally, we find out that he is Eli whatever and Eli Weinraub. And eventually, Mr. Eli reveals to Cal that we learned that he was a World War II vet. Because conveniently, Cal is like a World War II obsessive person. And he's like, yeah, I know everything about World War II. And I did the research, and you led the boat that won the Battle of blah, blah, blah. AKA, maybe you've heard of it, the Battle of Normandy. Like, might as well wink to the camera, like, you guys know, the good one.
Yeah.
You guys are smart. Gosh. It's the one that won, he's the one that won the war. And this guy, and Mr. Eli really wants this old photo, which eventually Cal gives to him, and before he calls him a cab, he has Matt and Danny come down. And they reminisce with this beautiful, sweet, perfect old man from a better time than ours about the good old days of comedy, which were basically just like ours, except everyone was white and more racist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is embarrassing.
It's so up its own ass. Completely. Fully. Like, more than usual.
And even like the expression on the face of Bradley Whitford as it's like, okay, and now you're going to sit here and smile and nod as this old man points at photos. It like even the actors feel like they are like indulging Aaron Sorkin and they don't want to be here.
Yeah.
Yes.
I sort of loved Bradley Whitford's wry apathy there of the line where it's like, you know, they didn't like things being too political back then. And he's like, oh, back then. Which is a good line. But then it really reads through what you're saying there. Where Bradley Whitford's like,
politics. Right. And he's like, the network wouldn't let us do these like political sketches. And he's like, yeah, network. Yeah.
What? Totally.
I know what that's like, Eli. I couldn't get it out of my head that Eli Wallach played Tuco in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's the thing that's been in my head. Sucks. Yeah. He played a man.
I was... Oh, wow. That's awful. Yep. I was scrolling through his Wikipedia page and my eyes landed on this sentence. During the filming of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Wallach nearly died 3 times.
Oh, cool. Rock and roll.
Yeah. Once he accidentally drank a bottle of acid, which was placed next to his pop bottle. Another time, he was in a scene where he was about to be hanged. Someone fired a pistol, which caused the horse underneath him to bolt and run a mile while Wallach's hands were still tied behind his back. In a different scene with him lying on a railroad track, he was close to being decapitated by steps jutting out from the train.
Yeah, that
the good old days of cinema.
The good, the bad, and the ugly days of cinema. When people could die at any moment because we put a bottle of acid next to their soda. Sounds like a cartoon.
Classic prank, to be honest.
Classic. That's the new punk looks wild. Did you hear they're doing a new punk with like Chance the Rapper?
Yes.
Ugh.
Oh, no.
No is correct. Do we have anything else to say about this dumb plot? They like eventually they just reminisce with him, and that's actually how the episode ends.
It's weird because I feel like it could have actually been a nice moment.
Mm-hmm.
Is the thing where they're like, oh, wait, you were like from like one, you were, you know, a victim of the Hollywood blacklist, which is a real shitty moment in history. And yeah. I think there can be some empathy for that. And also like, oh, you're part of the rich history of this theater that we've been going on about all episode. And you were like, well, I guess this is going to go somewhere because you're talking about this, but I don't care. But the payoff is just like, yeah, an old man pointing at a photo.
Wow, the good old days.
Yeah, they're like, listen, we're going to need like 4 or 5 hours for you to explain everything. And he just sits there and goes, well, this is Dave. He was good at jokes. This is Johnny. He was okay at jokes. It's just like, why?
It also totally, it takes away any, I don't know, like the fact that he's sort of senile and they don't understand what is going on with him at first. And they're like, come on, talk to us, tell us. That also makes it feel really kind of disrespectful, I guess. Or like he's like a zoo animal almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like he has no connection to them either. So it's not like a character's visiting their grandpa or something. He's just like a dude who showed up. And yeah.
Well, and across these episodes, well, mostly this episode, to be honest, there are several instances of just like how self-important these characters are, and I guess like Sorkin sees his holy work, right? Where you've got like there's never a point where they ask what this old man wants.
Right.
They're like, here's what's going to happen to you, and they say like they change their mind three different times. They call him a cab, and then they cancel it so he can hang out and point at a photo for 3 hours. and then there's also like there's the co-host of this episode, the guest, Lauren Graham.
Yep.
Who has the conversation and is like, hey, why'd you cut that sketch? I thought it was funny. And then Matt like writes his number on a post notes like, here, call you're gonna babe. Want this. And she starts to walk away and she's like, but I do want that number. I guess I'm gonna have to humble myself before the holy king of comedy. And then even at the end, which in a segment we're gonna talk to, there's this bit where they go to this like stand-up comedian when he's after the bathroom and his sketch went badly, like, wow, you suck, you're terrible, you're garbage. What if you just like quit everything forever because you suck so bad?
Anyways,
anyway, you work for me, call me sir. And it's like, you suck so bad.
Yeah.
I hate all of you.
They're very commanding over these people. Yeah, a lot of this episode is about like the cast and crew of the show explaining to people who don't understand things how they work.
It's that, like
happens
you just
with,
made...
that happens with Tom, that happens with the old, with Eli, and that happens with both comedians.
Yeah.
It's like you just made this man like your fief, and you're like, now thank me for it. It's like,
kiss my
piss
feet.
Off.
Yeah. Ugh. So can we crunch into that now, please? Please? Please?
Yeah, we must. We simply must.
We simply must. So at some point in the episode, Simon comes up to Matt and he says, listen, you keep writing sketches for me. Everyone keeps writing sketches for me. You don't have a single black person in your writer's room, which is true and is a great point. He says, why don't you have one? And then, like Magellan was predicting, he's like, what's the problem with me not having one? I hire good writers. He's like, yeah, but also all of your writers go to Harvard. Like, even if they were, like, not all white, they also are all just, like, college-educated white people. Like, they're a specific type of, like, you know, West Coast liberal, and that sucks. And he's like, we're not all West Coast liberals. And then Matt just drops, ding, 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 racism number one. Oh, and he says, I was a bartender for Patti LaBelle. All the black people would always go to the black bartender because they thought that he was the only one who knew how to make black drinks. And then Simon's like, huh, that's a really, wait, you could have wrote that joke. Why don't you write that? Oh, because your liberal guilt will come spraying out of your ears. You dummy. You don't know how to talk to black people, which is true.
There's so many, like, God, this little conversation is so intensely unlikable. In so many ways, where you have like Danny being like, what was wrong, don't I do a good enough job for you? And it's like, my dude, it is an entire show and you have a staff of writers that you have already been established in the show to be actively neglecting and abusing.
Yes,
you don't get to be self-righteous here.
Just humble also, yourself for like 5 minutes.
Also, he's like, what is this, a diversity problem? Yes, it is.
Yes, it literally is. Yes, there's a reason for that. Yes. It's okay to listen to other people, Matt Albee. You don't have to be a dick about this.
Albee.
Because it's not just like Matt Albee sucks. It's not just that Matt Albee is. It's in the blood of the show that the idea is that Matt is coming to understand that the way that you give voices to people of color is by hiring them and just by giving the right one the job. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a meritocracy over an actual like push for diversity, which is the frustrating conclusion of this plot line. Because he's yelling at Simon about, like, I know how black people work. I just don't hire them because, I don't know, they're not coming in. I'm not finding good ones, etc. Fine, I'll go with you. And they go to a comedy club. Yeah, what's up, Majone?
Well, it's like the Matt Albee is not painted as enough of a bigot.
Right.
Yeah. And there's so many little, like, every little detail about this is so crummy. Like, even the part where he's like, fine, you've emotionally blackmailed me into coming to this thing with you, but I've still got to have power here. We're taking my car.
Because I have to be.
Go away!
He can't.
The episode never reckons with, like, there are a lot of different ways that this plot is racist, and it never really reckons with that racism that Matt expresses in that first scene where he says, why do you want a black writer? I could write as good for black people as any black writer. So what's the, and it's like, that's not exactly what it's about, Matt. Like, it is about that, but it's also just like, you don't hire black writers to write the sketches for the black actors. You hire black writers to write sketches.
Period.
That they think are funny and that maybe you wouldn't have thought of because
you're trying to make a creative show that appeals to people. And how can you appeal to people who you don't understand as well?
And Simon's like, well, why? I mean, can it be valuable to have other perspectives for comedy? And Matt's like, I have every perspective. And it's like, I've
lived a long life. I'm 38 or whatever. Like, shut up.
I hate you.
So this is the true falling out of my standing desk scene. He goes to go to this comedy club and he sees a guy. What's the comedian's name? It's like
Willie Wills.
Willie Wills. And here's the frustrating thing is I've seen this perspective in comedy before. This is a real and like accurate portrayal of like how white men think of comedy, which is that it has to be smart and it has to portray the people in it positively. And it has to be sort of like intellectual, which is a lot of what they complain, like the Studio 60 sketches need to be more intellectual and like thinky. Willie Wills' comedy is in. It's obviously it's supposed to appear. It's lowest common denominator. It's easy comedy because he's at a comedy club for just doing jokes for money. Like it's not. He's not doing like high like theater here. He's talking about like I have all these girlfriends and I like girls with big butts and all this stuff. And you watch Simon, not only Matt but also Simon, be like, ugh. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, this disgusting, the garbage comedy. Oh, I can't believe he talks about sex and black people. God, people hate white people. Oh, this is so bad. This is trash comedy. I ruined your night by doing this to you, Matt Albee. This, like, boiled. My piss is boiled once again. Weekly, I'm getting a regular piss boiling from this show. Because, again, like, this comedy's fine. It's a little simple, but people like it. It's like you write comedy.
I mean,
that people laugh
I think
at.
It's bad. Like I do agree with the critique that it's sexist and it's rote and it's bad.
But the problem is, this is from this show, which doesn't have any better jokes.
That too
doesn't have any better jokes, and clearly Simon is the mouthpiece for the white writer.
Yes.
Also,
yes. And the sketch, this like Willie Will sketch is written by a white writer.
Yeah. Like, right.
All of this is contained within the mouth of like the pen of a white writer. Like,
yeah.
The show, it's like damning with praise in this show where it's like, yeah, you can't make this claim that like, okay, this is why some black comedy can be really great. It's like, no.
And also, like, there are plenty of white comedians
who do this kind of shit.
Yeah. Who do like racist jokes and do sexist jokes, and it's not like a black stand-up thing.
Yeah.
It's like a bad stand-up thing.
And black stand-up has this particular reputation for being like this, of being like loud and obnoxious and sexist. And like every time I used to watch a lot of Comedy Central Presents, I got a lot of like my early stand-up favorites from watching that stuff. And yeah, it's a lot of like old white guys doing like, I hate my wife and I love drinking and stuff like that. And there was a decent amount of like black comics on there doing this kind of thing, but some of it's clever. Like, this is not the norm, I think. And they really hate it, and they really complain about it, and they're like, this is so bad. And they kind of have a Back to the Future moment, where he's like, man, I'm really sorry. Like, well, I'm such a failure. We're sitting at the bar. We're making fun of that guy. And he hears another man speaking next up on the set. He's like, hold on. Simon, shut up for a sec. And Simon's going, blah, 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 black people and butts. And he's like, Simon, shut the fuck up. And he just keeps going. And he turns around, and it's like a voice from the heavens. And it's this new comedian who's doing good comedy. And his comedy is like, it's good. It's better. He's talking about like the cultural diaspora and like feeling different from his peers. And like, I don't know how to do comedy that other people do. And he's bombing. He's just bombing because he's not appealing to his audience.
His delivery is bad, specifically.
Exactly. He's like not, yeah, he's not delivering well. And you can tell he's like a little shaky and his confidence is rough. And Matt says, like, with a little bit of discipline, I hate the line of a white man telling a black man with a little bit of discipline, you'd be really good. I hate that. I hate that. I don't like anything about that. And they go up to him backstage. And again, let's ding, 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 fall out of the chair one more time. They're like, hey, where are you from? Simon's like, yeah, I know what area of the city you're from because I know the city really well. I know what street you lived on or what, like, I know the neighborhood you're from. And talks about, like, where are you going to go after this? And he's like, I'm going to go out with my friends because I'm bad at comedy. And they're like, yeah, you were bad, dude. Like, you were bad. No, like, you were the worst. And he's like, thanks. I'm going to go cry now and get drunk. And they're like, no, you're bad and you deserve a job. Huh? You deserve a job writing for Studio 60. You start tomorrow. Really? Yes. And not only that, but like, come in. This is like the thing that comedians of color have to deal with every fucking day for their lives. Come in early, stay late, don't talk back to people. That guy is your boss. Do everything he says and lick his fucking boots.
Yeah.
That's Matt Albee. That's your job. Take it. And then Simon takes him aside and is like, don't fuck this up for me. I'm giving this to you. You need to know that
this is a gift that you did not earn.
You just everything. Where do you start with this scene, folks? Where do you start?
I would prefer not to if you're giving me the choice.
I do think that there are aspects of Simon's arc in this episode that I think if they had been written by someone for whom that was like actually their experience, they would ring true and happen in a way that felt better.
The swimming like pool stuff in particular.
What'd you say?
The swimming pool stuff and the idea of like, I can see my...
You can see the prison from my rich guy swimming pool.
Yes. Yeah, that stuff's good.
It's like pretty powerful. But even this scene too, well, and what he says in that other scene of like, I want to be able to save like as many people as I can.
Yeah. The whole exchange is really good.
This episode does, by the way, have another racist problem of like conflating blackness with like being from the hood, which is an issue anyway. It's
sure.
We're unraveling many, many problems here. But in this scene, even like the idea of Simon pulling aside the new guy and there being a kind of camaraderie and like we're watching each other's backs and listen, you kind of have to kiss up to this white guy because he's like really full of himself. I think if that had been written in a way that was more critical of Matt and more directly acknowledging like, okay, so this guy's racist. I had to work him over all night to get him to hire one black guy. So it sucks, but you're
our only hope, Obi-Wan.
Yeah, like your position is on thin ice just because like that's how he operates. So I'm with you and I'm looking out for you and like we're gonna figure this out, but know that like you gotta perform for this dude because he's gonna be watching you. I think there's a way that could have been written, and I think what's here gestures towards that, but because it's being written by the guy for whom Matt Albee is like his stand-in directly. And so Matt Albee is going to be like the perfect guy always. Instead, it's like, hey, listen, buddy, that dude is a fucking genius. Okay. Yeah. And you should feel thankful to be working for him. Yeah.
It's a bit rough.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting also that Aaron Sorkin's idea of like the smart black comedian, you walk in and the first thing that he's talking about is slavery.
Yeah. What?
And it's like, I guess, yeah, there it can be some smart comedy about slavery, but that feels like a problem that it's like, no, this is what the black comedians should be talking about.
Yeah. Oh, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
Do we have any other thoughts on this plot line before I melt?
I think this could have
been so good.
I think it could have been really good.
Yep.
And I think Aaron Sorkin just is incapable of writing it good.
Yeah. This is not the plot line for him. This is not the plot line for this show. But this is a good plot line for some show, for some writer, maybe.
Yeah, I think in the world where Studio 60, like, I think Studio 60 is a fine idea for a show.
Yeah.
And I think that if you were devising Studio 60 from scratch and trying to figure out, like, okay, what should our episodes be about?
Yeah.
I think this idea of, like, white men being the dominant voices in comedy would have to be a central theme of the show. And so an episode like this definitely belongs in a dramatic show about the creation of a sketch comedy series.
Right.
But Sorkin's just not, he's not the guy who can do it.
Mm-mm. Swing and a miss.
Yeah.
Six, any thoughts?
No, we've gone through it. Do I? Yeah.
This is the end of therapy.
I'm so tired. We're so tired.
Yeah. Yeah. This episode definitely wore me out. Let's take it to the close then. John, do you want to tell us what we're watching next time on Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats?
I would love to. This show's fun.
Sure.
It's good. It's a good show to watch. It's not bad. It's good.
Oh, right? I was mistaken. Sorry. Yeah, I was wrong.
Everybody's happy that we're watching Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Sorry, my mouse disappeared from my computer screen, so I need to do this on my phone.
Oh, gamers, we got a two-parter next week.
Yeah, gamers. All right, listen up, gamers. So next week we are watching episodes 7 and 8. I remember that this is like, I think this is where I stopped watching.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Getting into new territory.
I think it is.
I have summaries up if you want.
No, I'm looking at it now.
Oh, okay.
I got it. Okay. Next time we're watching episodes 7 and 8. They are Nevada Day parts 1 and 2. I'm just going to say I remember this being bad.
Boy.
Wait, what?
No, I know, but I think it is. Nevada Day Part 1. An unusual collection of people must go to a small town in Nevada to get Tom out of jail in time for the show that night. Tom's in jail and they got to get him out.
Okay.
Nevada Day Part 2. Jack has to get Tom out of a small town jail in order for him to make it back for the show that night.
They built up Tom in this episode so that we can get a whole Tom episode next.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way Tom is essential enough that they would be like, we gotta get him tonight. He's gotta be on the show.
But your brother is standing in the middle of a small town jail.
In Afghanistan.
Actually, I think it's in Nevada.
No, yeah. In yes.
Yeah.
That's exciting. Can we take it to the plugs down then?
Yeah, let's do it.
If you're listening to this, then congratulations. You made it to the end of the episode.
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
Great. What's wrong with you? Why'd you do that?
If you're listening to this, you love to hear people suffer.
We are Chats, and we are one half of Scanline Media. Our email is chatspod@gmail.com. Our Twitter is @chatspod. Six, do you have a Twitter account?
I do. It's @6detmar, SIXDETTMAR.
Fabulous. You can rate us on Apple Podcasts or whatever your podcast platform of choice is. We have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/chatspod. It's where you can get all of our bonus content for just $3 a month. You get all sorts of fun stuff that you can vote on. And at the end of this episode, I want to do the best chatsums we've ever done to wash ourselves of Studio 60. Six, what is your chatsum for this week?
My chatsum for this week is Snickers.
Ooh, they satisfy?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, you know, I've been spending time in the lockup, in the lockdown.
Uh-huh.
and I have a bag of fun-sized Snickers, and sometimes I'm like, hey, I should get up from my desk and stop working. And I was like, what if instead I just had a Snickers and kept working?
I actually really enjoy Snickers. Yeah.
And working.
I love working.
Yeah, it's great. Please take care of yourselves, people. That's my chatsum is self-care in these trying times.
Yeah.
John, what about you? What's your chatsum for this week?
It's really funny that Six said Snickers, because I was like, okay, I'm going to be the one this week who has just a useless chatsum.
Wait, what are you trying to say?
Wait a minute,
I'm saying that I'm looking at a box of Cheez-Its on my desk, and my chatsum is Cheez-Its.
That's fair. It's fair. It's quarantine, baby.
And the moment that I thought Cheez-Its, Six said Snickers, and I'm like, okay, I guess that's this one. They're good though, man.
Just regular Cheez-Its.
Yeah, you don't need to mix it up. You don't need the flavors. You don't need the big ones. You don't need the extra cheese. They're just a great baked snack cracker.
Okay, you know what? I'll give you a secondary chatsum then.
Okay.
Ooh, what is it?
It's also going to be food, but it's going to be... So, okay, you're like, hey, I'm stuck indoors. How am I supposed to get like ingredients, and how am I supposed to make food, and I want junk food? Hey, check it out, folks. You know what's really easy to make? With ingredients that are easy to find and rules.
What?
Italian beef.
Oh. Okay.
Make an Italian beef sandwich. If you don't know what that is, it's a Chicago classic. It is a modified version of the French dip. And it rules. You just take a chunk of beef and you just cook it for like 2 hours, 3 hours. And then you shave it and there's au jus and there's, you know, peppers, and it's really good.
Au jus. I have a secondary chatsum as well.
Oh, snap.
Ooh.
Malamars.
Ooh. Ooh. Would y'all tell the story? Tell the story. About the time that we got Malamars. Because we were like, what are Malamars? Would it be funny if we bought a box of Malamars, and then we did and we hated it?
I don't remember.
This was at our mutual friend's house. We like stayed the night.
Oh.
We had Malamars.
You told the story. That's the story.
Yeah, there you go. I told the whole story. We were at the supermarket. We were buying food to cook with our friend James. And we saw a box of Malamars, and we're like, that probably sucks, right? And we bought it, and we bought like peanut butter, and we were like dipping Malamars in peanut butter, and we're like, this sucks.
Yeah.
Malamars in isolation are fine. They're okay.
I impulse bought a box of Malamars, and I've had like about 4 Malamars a day since
I've my God.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend combining marshmallow and peanut butter. That doesn't sound.
It can. Ideally. It can be good. When you're drunk.
What's your chance though?
So this episode, the second episode, made me really frustrated about the way that we're talking about black comics. And my favorite black comic is Nicole Byer. She's extremely funny. She is the host of the best food show on TV right now on Netflix, which is called, what is the show actually called? Nailed It.
Oh.
I love Nailed It. I love Nicole Byer. I think she's extremely funny. Any podcast you find her on, you're going to have a great laugh. She's very talented and funny and charming. And you should just, her entire body of work right now is excellent. She's got a funny voice. She's got good bits. She's done a little bit of stand-up. She's a good reality show host. Go support black comics, please. Please. Do me this favor. Thank you.
Please. Please.
Thank you.
Okay.
And.
You talked me into it.
Six, I've talked to you about the one bit of hers that I really, really love, where it's Kathy having sex.
Yes.
Yeah. That's from her. Yeah. So everyone, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Studio 60 on the Sunset Chats. We're starting the clock.
What? Let's restart the clock.
Let's restart the clock. I don't ever. I never know how to word it though, but
it's me, the clock.
Tag clock yourself. It up.
Clock them down. Clock it.
Clocking out.
Clock tower.
Clock and roll. Clock, clock around the clock. Clock around the clock. Yeah, think about that. A stopped clock is still a clock all the time. What does it mean to be a clock? Does it have to function to be a clock? Anyway, thank you so much for listening to that episode of Sunset Chats. We really appreciate
your listenership, and your support. I wanted to come in here just to give a couple extra plugs and announcements and some additional thoughts on tacked on to the end of the episode that I was having as I was editing that, actually. So on top of the stuff we said about contacting the show and supporting the show on Patreon, you can also, through the Patreon, join our Discord server. People are having fun in there, having convos about TV, watching us, not watching us, but joining us as we watch commentary chats, movies from time to time, things like that. And then we're working on a website. It's coming out fairly soon. In terms of what's coming at you on the Patreon in February, if you're curious about whether or not you want to support the show, next Saturday we are releasing a Chats Nights where Alan and I decided to impulsively rank the Star Wars films because we've been in a Star Wars mood. After that, the following Saturday is a movie commentary chats on the film The Princess Bride, which I had never seen before, and we're doing that for Valentine's Day. And then the other two bonus episodes we're going to release in February are us piloting some recent miniseries to try to figure out what is going to go into season 11 of Chats following Studio 60. So you can join us there and help us to figure out what we should be doing next season. We've got a couple ideas, but we're trying to narrow things down. And then in terms of what was in this episode, first of all, I want to say that in between the time that we recorded this and now, I've seen all of Gilmore Girls, and so just I wish I had known that to be there to defend Lauren Graham's honor a little bit and just say that, you know, she was criminally underutilized in the episode, and, you know, she should be in more stuff. Lauren Graham is fantastic. And then the other thing I would say is I think we did a good job talking about the Simon stuff and the sort of race stuff in this episode. But just to put a fine point on it, you know, I think the critique here of the way that Studio 60 handles race has a couple components. First of all, it's just that classic thing of, oh, you know, I'm colorblind, merit is what should matter, I could write a joke for anybody, which is obviously an argument that is used to, rather than open doors, close doors, and defend the status quo and defend the power of white men by saying like, oh, you know, we're all funny, so there's no problem here. So that's part of it. And then I think the second part is that Matt Albee is presented as doing Darius a favor by giving him a job. And then a kind of third issue, and then we talked, and we'll talk a lot more. There's a later episode where there's some additional race stuff and conflict, and we dig into this more. But then I think the last thing is just, you know, the way that this plot related to Sorkin's overall emphasis on erudition being, and like fact knowing being, the ultimate determinant of whether or not you have value as a person. And so Darius, his comedy wasn't good to them because it was funny. His comedy was good because he was talking about pseudo intellectual things in it, and he was a dude who wore glasses. And I think there's also the racism inherent in the way the camera sees a character like that, who is black and smart, as a kind of surprise, and that is an inherently racist thing as well. So there's just a lot of layers that I think we were speaking towards, but I wanted to put a point on it there. And we'll unfold those ideas more as the season goes on. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, everybody. Again, we really, really appreciate it. If you could help us out by sharing the show with your friends, by reviewing us on iTunes, by helping us to get some more listeners. We're trying to make a push, promotional push this season. We want to see those numbers expand, so however you can help us do that would be really great. We appreciate it. Other than that, have a wonderful, it's a wonderful life. Have a wonderful clock on down to the clock town store and buy yourself a clock.